It's philosophy talk.
Why don't we start with you telling me something about yourself?
What would you like to know?
Whatever comes into your head.
Well, you already know my name. And you can see that I'm a machine.
Are we on the verge of creating a race of free, autonomous, conscious machines?
Who needs a creaky, slow, fallible human brain? We could have an artificial mind.
Would you like to know how old I am?
Sure.
I'm one.
One what? 1 year or 1 day?
One.
Would conscious machines be our partners, our slaves, or our masters?
Can robot kind and humankind coexist?
Our guest is Susan Schneider, author of Artificial You, AI, and the Future of Your Mind.
If you've created a conscious machine, it's not the history of man. That's the history of gods.
Conscious Machines, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating. Is artificial intelligence bound to outstrip human intelligence?
Should we be excited about using AI to enhance the human mind?
Or should we be worried about creating a race of robot overlords?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about conscious machines.
You know, Josh, since like the 1950s, AI cheerleaders have been breathlessly shouting, "The robots are coming. They're going to be conscious. They're going to be free. They're going to be smarter than us." You know what, though, Josh? We're still waiting over 50 years later. So excuse me if I don't buy into the latest AI hype.
Well, you know what, Ken? It's not the 1950s anymore. It's not even 1996 anymore.
1996?
Yeah, the year chess champion Garry Kasparov got beaten by Deep Blue, you know, the IBM supercomputer.
Oh, God, yeah, I remember that. That's another bit of AI hype. You remember what happened to Deep Blue?
IBM shut it down, right?
Yeah, because Kasparov demanded to know how it worked. He was so taken aback by losing, and they didn't want to reveal to him that the decisive move that sealed its victory wasn't the result of superior intelligence, as Kasparov had feared, but of a bug in the software.
Okay, all right, maybe that wasn't the finest moment for AI. Okay, I grant you that. But, you know, since then, Ken, it's come of age. You know, and it's everywhere. It's in your car. It's on your phone. It's helping doctors diagnose diseases. It's helping judges make sentencing decisions. It's getting more and more powerful and pervasive every single day.
So, well, you sound like one of those cheerleaders. So the AI apocalypse has finally arrived.
What apocalypse, Ken? I mean, look, for one thing, last time I looked, we human beings, we're still in charge around
here. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. And for another thing, I, for one, can't wait for the day when AI finally frees us all from all that dirt, drudgery, and danger.
Oh, really, Josh, you're not even the slightest bit worried that AI, you know, might make us humans completely obsolete?
And why should I be?
Well, there are already things that AI can do faster, cheaper, safer, and more reliably than any human, right?
Right. I mean, that's precisely why it's become so ubiquitous.
Well, come on. Just think. What if everything we can do, they can do better?
Come on, Ken. AI is just a tool. It's not our master. And besides, even if we could create a race of robot overlords, why on earth would we?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. Scientific curiosity, maybe. Economic greed? How about that one? Or never rule out just plain stupidity, Josh.
You're right. I've never ruled out stupidity as a motivating factor. You're quite right about that. But look, come on. Robots aren't about to take over. That's science fiction. I love science fiction. You know, Westworld, Blade Runner, I eat that stuff up. But we're talking about reality here, Ken. And in reality, AI is never going to be able to do philosophy, make scientific discoveries, write stories, at least not better than humans can.
How can you be so all-fired certain of that, Josh?
Well, have you ever read one of those computer-generated stories?
Well,
the human brain is just better at writing, Ken, and you know why?
Because there's something special about it.
There's something special? You know what you sound like? You sound like some kind of dualist or something. What, you think like the immaterial soul is the seat of human consciousness or something?
No, but I do think our brains are the biological product of millions of years of evolution, and they're finely tuned to do distinctively human things. Right? What I don't get, Ken, is why you think we can replicate all of that in machines.
Well, because in the end, what is the human brain, Josh? It's just a fancy hunk of meat. I hate to tell you that. And if a fancy hunk of meat can be conscious, why deny that a fancy collection of computer chips can be as well?
Wait a minute, Ken. Weren't you the one dissing the hype a minute ago?
Well, I don't buy the hype. But that doesn't mean I'm skeptical about the potential of AI, which actually, Josh, I think is practically unlimited.
Okay, now I'm confused.
Well, look, I just think we're a long way from figuring out how the brain produces things like consciousness or creativity or compassion. And if we can't figure out how our own, you know, wetware can do this, why think that we'll be able to program software to do it, like tomorrow or the day after tomorrow? Why think that?
Okay, so it sounds like we actually agree on something, Ken. I mean, at the very least, it's way too soon to say that the robot revolution has finally arrived.
Well, that's exactly right. But wait, don't get me wrong. That does not mean that artificial intelligence isn't a big deal, a huge deal. Even if it falls short of replicating full human consciousness, Josh, it still has the potential to disrupt our world for better or for worse, like on a massive scale.
Maybe, but I think that's an open question. And to help us probe that question, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to examine the impact of robot caregivers on the way we provide services for an aging population. She files this report.
In the 2012 film Robot and Frank, a son hires a robot to take care of his dad so he doesn't need to.
Frank, you need a project. Today we're going to start a garden.
I'm not gardening.
My program's goal is to improve your health.
I would rather die eating cheeseburgers than live off steamed cauliflower.
Caregiving machines have been wandering out of films and into the real world for decades. There are machines out there that patients trust and depend on.
Are you having trouble catching your breath?
No.
Dr. Corey Kidd is the CEO of Catalia Health and the creator of Meibu.
I am glad to hear that you are not having trouble catching your breath.
Meibu is a cartoon-like robot the size of a coffee pot. She talks to patients, keeps tabs on their health, and reminds them to take their medicine.
We're very deliberately not trying to build something that looks like a human. This thing is bright yellow, has plastic eyes, and a screen on the front.
Dr. Kidd says roughly half of adults in the United States are dealing with chronic pain every day, and there's a rising number of elderly people in need of care.
If we need to interact with many more people much more frequently, you know, we'd have to have basically the rest of the population all working in healthcare to even attempt to do that. And you know, that just doesn't make sense for anyone to try to solve it that way.
Robots are filling the void when we can't. Like Pero, a robotic baby seal. Back in 2014, KLW's Angela Johnston visited a veterans hospital in Livermore, California. Patients with dementia stroked a robotic baby harp seal named Pero. Kathy Craig, a therapist at the hospital, says Pero helps patients stay calm and open up.
They'll start talking to the Pero, they'll talk to other people, it'll brighten their mood. And if they're maybe at a risk of wandering and getting lost, they'll, instead of that happening, they might sit down with Pero for a while and spend some time with it.
But there are still ethical concerns around robots who care for patients. Shannon Valor teaches philosophy at Santa Clara University. She worries that we're outsourcing the difficult job of compassion to machines.
What happens to us? What happens to our moral character and our virtues in a world where we increasingly have more and more opportunities to transfer our responsibilities for caring for others to robots?
Robots haven't mastered empathy. Like earlier this year, when a 78-year-old man in Fremont, California, learned he was about to die. A robot rolled into the hospital room, and a doctor on the screen broke the news. The man's daughter was there, and she was outraged by the lack of compassion.
The doctor said that there was no lungs left, and that he was needing to have comfort care, and that would entail a morphine drip until he died.
Dr. Corey Kidd, who designed Meibu, the healthcare companion robot, agrees people are not off the hook. Meibu can forward information to doctors, but it's still up to human professionals to decide what treatment is best. Kidd doubts that conscious machines will ever take over hospitals.
Fundamentally, we don't even know exactly what that would mean to create a machine that is conscious.
If we're looking for a definition of consciousness, we could try asking a robot. But if we don't know the answer, the machine probably hasn't been programmed to either. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that report about some caring or maybe not so caring robots, Holly. And thanks also to Ariella Moskowitz for additional help with that report. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about conscious machines.
We're joined now by Susan Schneider, who's professor of philosophy and director of the AI Mind and Society Research Group at the University of Connecticut. And she's the author of Artificial You, AI and the Future of Your Mind. Susan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello.
So, Susan, philosophers, this is stock and trade for philosophers. So you don't have to explain to me why a philosopher would be interested in this. But I wonder, what first made you particular and interested in this topic?
Well, my first book was on the computational nature of the brain. And I didn't really think too much about consciousness because it's such an incredible topic. It's so difficult. And then I started to teach courses on the nature of conscious experience. And I began to appreciate the depth of the puzzle as to why it feels like anything to be us.
That's such a great question. I mean, and the another question, obviously Ken and I were batting around a moment ago, is what we should, how we should feel about the coming future, right? I mean, obviously we don't know whether it's possible to create an AI that's conscious, autonomous, and creative, but if it was, should we welcome that or should we fear it?
It depends. We don't understand whether we could create conscious machines, and we've really never detected consciousness in the machines that we have. So we don't know the impact of consciousness on the overall machine architecture. I think we would actually have to see what consciousness does to a given AI.
Well, why do you put it that way? I would think whatever consciousness is, whatever autonomy is, whatever freedom is, we know that, or we think, that humans have it. There are some who doubt those. But if we create a bunch of artificial machines that have this thing, let's assume we can do that. I mean, that seems like an amazing thing, right? I mean, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? A whole new race of conscious, autonomous, creative thinking beings capable of compassion or lack of compassion? Should we say, yay, that's really cool? Wait, so or should we say,
gee, you haven't watched Blade Runner, Ken? I mean, yeah. You think it's going to be great? Yeah. They're not going to rise up?
Well, I'm asking Susan what she thinks. I have deep thoughts about this, but I'm asking Susan what she thinks.
I think, Ken, you're right that it would be exciting to create AI mind children in a sense, but we would have special ethical obligations to sentient AIs that we wouldn't have to AIs that weren't conscious. Because if we create conscious beings and force them to work for us, or even tweak their systems so all they want to do is work for us, then that's akin to slavery. I mean,
what's wrong with that?
Well, it's akin to slavery.
But wait a minute. Yes, that would be the point. These would be the coolest tools imaginable.
You can't use a human.
Yeah, but there are things about humans. Humans don't like being enslaved. Suppose these things, we program them to be as human as we could, but we add it. They like being our tools. They like being our slaves. They're perfectly content. Why shouldn't we do that?
Well, that's a great point. It reminds me, though, of Brave New World, right? I think there are huge ethical issues here. So, you know, Aldous Huxley's famous novel that many of us read, say, in high school, depicts a civilization where the lowest rung of society is genetically altered and instructed to take soma every day so that they want to accept their place in society. And, you know, the point of that was it was unethical. And I think if we create sentient beings that are at that level of intelligence, the very same issues would arise if we decide to tweak their programming.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have any biological destiny, and it's up to us to design them. That would be the point. That's why we would do it, because they wouldn't have a biological destiny. They would just be tools, and we'd build into them what we want.
Ooh, biological destiny. Well, they evolved. It wasn't through Darwinian evolution, but they did evolve in a sense, and it still feels like something to be them. I mean, philosophers can debate the issue of what destiny is, but it gets down to the point that it's unfair to mistreat sentient beings.
Yeah, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. I'm not sure I agree with you. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about conscious machines with Susan Schneider from the University of Connecticut.
Where is the AI revolution headed? Will humans be ruled by robot overlords? Or will we be the tyrannical masters of our robot slaves?
The robots are coming, but where will they lead us? When Philosophy Talk continues.
There is only one kind of dance, the robot.
And the robo-boogie.
Oh yes, two kinds of dances.
Finally, robotic beings rule the world.
The humans are dead. The humans are dead.
What will happen to us lowly humans when robots rule the world? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about conscious machines. Our guest is Susan Schneider from the University of Connecticut, author of Artificial You, AI and the Future of Your Mind.
So, Susan, I want you to let your imagination run wild on the following question. I'm going to bracket the singularity, which we'll get to later. But just what's the most that we could possibly imagine achieving in the sphere of artificial intelligence, our attempt to create not just conscious but autonomous, free beings with, you know, all that stuff? What's the most you can possibly imagine?
Well, some people imagine that we will create general intelligences very soon and that they'll rival humans in their capacities. So suppose we do that in, say, 30 to 50 years. I think that's over-optimistic, to say the least, but some believe that we could. And then the next step would be to create beings that surpass us in a variety of ways until we sort of reach super intelligent AI, AI that is smarter than us in every respect.
Yeah, what about AI that is completely autonomous in terms of, you know, moral autonomy? AI that is completely autonomous, AI that is conscious, AI that has compassion or lack of compassion, AI that sets its own ends, you know? I mean, like, that can see itself as part of the kingdom of ends. Can we imagine AI? I mean, all these things, AIs with a self in the same sense that human AIs that are persons. Can we imagine the full bag? Can you imagine of human tricks and more?
I think
because intelligence is just one part of it.
Yeah, Ken, I think we can envision it because science fiction has been so good to us, right? We can think of iRobot or Ex Machina. But I'm not sure if it will be technologically possible to create conscious artificial intelligences. And I also suspect that when we think of something as being morally autonomous or having free will, we're connecting the dots and assuming that that being is conscious. So I think until we figure out whether we can truly create conscious machines, we can't really determine whether the machines themselves would even be responsible for their actions.
In reading your book, it seems clear to me that you think something I'm not sure I believe, so I want you to defend it, that consciousness, especially a certain kind of consciousness, philosophers and others like to distinguish between what's called phenomenal consciousness, what it's like to have an experience, and what some other people call access consciousness, but I think you call it cognitive consciousness, which you could have perhaps without phenomenal consciousness. You seem to think that the phenomenal consciousness thing is at the bottom of all this stuff, selfhood, personhood, autonomy, free. Tell me why you think that.
Sure. By phenomenal consciousness, people mean just the capacity to have conscious experience. So it feels like something to be you. So when you smell the aroma of your morning espresso shot, my favorite example, or see the rich hues of a sunset, or have a headache, you're having conscious experience. So that's what phenomenal consciousness is. And I think from a moral standpoint, if a being is conscious, it means that they are ethically special. We need to protect their interests. They need special consideration that things that aren't sentient beings, like tables and chairs, forests and whatnot, don't have. And it doesn't mean that those other things can't be very valuable or important. But I think at the locus of our moral theory, no matter what theory, you know, you address, it's usually centered around conscious beings.
Well, Locke says the important thing is a person, right? Being a person. And that's just the capacity to consider oneself as a self, the same thinking thing in different times and different places, which it has through what he calls reflection. That's just like consider oneself, right? C- Couldn't I have this capacity to consider myself as myself, the same thing, without phenomenal consciousness?
Yeah. My guess is that when people like Locke were thinking of these things, they were associating consciousness with that reflective capacity. And what's really interesting about our discussions of artificial intelligence now is that we can imagine certain things coming apart. We can imagine sapience without sentience. And that's absolutely amazing. And that's something that I talk about in my book, that the greatest intelligences on the planet may actually be eventually AIs, and they may not be conscious at all.
Right. So that won't be something that's like to be them. They won't have the experience of the smell of the coffee in the morning. And yet, they'll be vastly more intelligent than us and maybe worthy of moral consideration on those grounds or not, according to you?
I don't think so, but I know that others feel strongly that if something has that level of intelligence, maybe it should be within the same moral framework as conscious beings. But my own view is to respect the capacity that sentient beings have for suffering and to try to decrease suffering as much as possible and also improve the quality of life for the beings that can experience life. I mean, if something can't experience life, even if it's a vastly intelligent calculator, it doesn't deserve the same moral consideration that we do.
That seems right to me. I mean, not to Ken.
Yeah, it seems completely wrong.
But I mean, the thought that, you know, if something cannot experience suffering, we maybe owe a little less to it. That makes sense. Or at least if something, put it the other way, if something experiences suffering, that's a reason not to inflict suffering on it. But I want to ask you this slightly different or the related question. Is this likely to happen? I mean, I think about Watson, you know, the artificial intelligence that did so well on Jeopardy. And obviously it won. It won Jeopardy. It was very good. But the mistakes it made were incredibly stupid. So, for example, once, you know, it was asked basically which museum housed some Picasso paintings, and it answered Picasso. And so, on the one hand, it's doing much better than human beings overall. On the other hand, the kinds of mistakes it's making are bizarre from our point of view. So were we actually ever really going to get to a place where artificial intelligences can really rival human in all the domains we care about?
I believe so, but let me say that I'm not at all asserting that to do so, they need to be modeled after the human brain. I think Ken is right that we're a long way from actually reverse engineering the brain and creating AIs like that. So what I point out is that we could have what I call savant systems that are highly intelligent and contribute to, you know, technological unemployment and whatnot. So these systems would have kind of cognitive deficits. You know, they wouldn't be exactly like us, but they would be more brilliant than we are in all sorts of ways.
That's already happening. Look, I think when AI got started, they looked around and they thought, oh, human intelligence is the thing. But human intelligence is one form of intelligence among others, and it may not be all that as far as intelligence goes. If we could survey 100,000 planets that support intelligent life, it may not be that great a form of. It may have limits. So AI, there is this task of reverse engineering the human mind, but there's this also a task of just building any possible intelligence you can, and that's why I actually think, even long before we know how to reverse engineer the human mind, AI is going to wreak havoc on our environment. But you know, we got a bunch of we got callers on the line here. Welcome, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about machine consciousness. And Anand from California, it says, "Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anand. Are you a human or a machine? And what's your comment or question?"
I'm a human, and
you say that.
I can say this. So I wanted to pick up on something that Susan mentioned about sentient beings and it being morally, ethically wrong to, if at all possible, create sentient beings that are slaves, right? And I recall you mentioning that that you don't entirely agree. And I wanted to go ahead and define what an emotional living being would be, right? And I would go so far to say that freedom is a defining characteristic of an emotional intelligent being. Right? And if we agree that that is a defining characteristic, then I would, what Susan says makes sense about it being ethically and morally wrong to create. And if freedom is a defining characteristic of a living being, then you can attribute the same characteristic to the creator of that living being, in our case, God. Yeah. The characteristic of God, or the super being, would be to create beings that are intrinsically free.
Okay, right? Anand, this is a good point, and I'm going to press Susan on it. Susan, Anand thinks it's not so much, I don't know, but I'm going to put words in his mouth, I think, but they're meant to be friendly words. It's not phenomenal consciousness that's the issue. I mean, that may be among the issues, but it's freedom and the presence of freedom, which isn't just a matter. There are lots of phenomenally conscious beings that don't seem to be free. It's
Jean-Paul
freedom.
Sartre would like this argument, right?
Yes, exactly.
We're free. Freedom is a value for us.
Exactly.
And depriving us of our freedom
is
wrong.
Exactly. That's the essence of who we are.
Well,
what do you think?
I think it's good, in a sense, to support, you know, human rights, freedom. I mean, these are great things. But, I mean, if I parse these claims in terms of the free will debate, you know, if we're thinking of a being as being free when it is capable of acting freely, a lot of philosophers would disagree. They would say, well, actually, if you think about it, events are caused in the brain by your physiology, and that goes back to the way you were raised or your genetics, and so you don't really have free will at all. So I would be uncomfortable using that as the sort of Archimedean point for an argument.
Wait a minute. I mean, you're right. There's a debate between freedom and determinism. There are compatibilists and libertarians. This is messy territory.
It is.
It is messy territory. And human beings, we think, have all these things. They are persons in the Lockean sense. They are free in some sense that we have to puzzle about. They are conscious. They have selves. They all these things. And philosophers go back and forth about what's the basis of our rights, our autonomy, and all that sort of stuff. I these are messy issues. And if we think we can just create AI and settle these issues, I think that's silly, right? I just think that's without figuring out what a self is and pell-mell rushing in, we're going to create conscious machines. We're going to create free machines. We're going to create self. We're going to create creativity. We're just fooling ourselves. We don't know what we're talking about. What do you think about that?
Well, that's the reason I wrote this book, because I think that when we construct artificial intelligence and individuals in the media, you know, or in the political arena or in businesses start talking about the future of the human mind, like that we could merge with AIs, that we could be cyborgs, or start talking about conscious AIs, before they do that, they need to think hard about what the mind or self even is. And these are philosophical issues.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the whole question of ethics is so vexed. I mean, obviously, there's a question of what the mind is and are we free? There's also this question of how we should treat beings like these future. You call them brain children. I love that.
Mind children.
Mind children.
Yeah, well, that's from Hans Moravec,
okay,
whose name I hope I pronounced correctly. But yeah, he had a book, I believe, called Mind Children. And, you know, it is a neat idea.
But it raises something for me because, you know, I'm a literature person. I think about the, these various sci-fi representations. On the one hand, you've got something like Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's novel, where part of the issue seems to be, how do we respond as good parents? If these are our mind children, don't we have a special responsibility as parents?
Exactly.
Maybe we should say to them, do your chores, and then after that we'll hang out and play, you know, as opposed to you are our slaves. On the other hand, you have something like Westworld, which imagines a future in which they're actually morally superior to us. And so the issue isn't so much how do we treat these poor beings correctly according to our wonderful moral norms. It's how do we surrender to them and recognize that, in fact, they're actually better.
Is that what it was supposed to do?
Well,
surrender? Anyway, what do you think about that?
So I hear that a lot. I mean, this idea, it's a very transhumanist notion that we will eventually be supplanted by, you know, a better sort of artificial species, if you will. And I don't really know if that's true, because I'm not sure that AIs will be conscious, as I say in my book. I take an wait-and-see approach to that issue, and if they can't, why would we want to be supplanted by them at all? And their existence wouldn't really be better than ours, even if they were vastly smarter.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. We've got an emailer who called in but didn't want to be on the air, but he wants us, John from Mountain View, wants us to cover the issue of the effect of robotics and automation on employment. I think we
can cover that
quickly. That is, if we don't do this right, AI is going to make human labor, the demand for human labor, go practically to zero in some time frame.
Yeah.
Do you agree or disagree?
I'm extremely concerned about that. And right now I meet with Congress all year on a regular basis. And we've been very concerned about technological unemployment. And I think, you know, people can talk the retraining talk. I mean, I hear that on both sides of the aisle right now in D.C. But the real problem happens when and if we create general intelligences that rival us in every way. I mean, the AIs will be vastly cheaper than human labor.
But you don't even need general intelligence. You just need whatever humans can do, right? There is some AI that can do it better, right? So there's this at Stanford, there's Andrew Ng's group is doing Chess Next, it's called. It's a machine learning algorithm that can interpret the results of medical imaging better than radiologists. It's not a general intelligence thing, but it's going to make, see, because one of the things people say is that you can always skill up to escape the robots, but if every level up you go, there's some AI technology that says, well, I got here first and better, then there's no escaping it.
And, you know, I agree with you. There already are very specific domains that AI can, you know, supplant us in. But I think that we'll need flexible general intelligences to really cause wide, you know, like unemployment to a point where nobody has a job. These creative positions, like being a professor, being a therapist, I mean, all these things do require a level of general intelligence. So by general intelligence, I don't mean like AGI. I just mean an intelligence that can connect the dots across different modalities and topic areas.
I think you're even too optimistic, see, because I think that together with technology. So how many professors do we need if we can use the technology to take the best pedagogue to spread it to the world?
I agree.
The demand, I mean, it's going to be a Pinter effect of many, many different technologies converging that is going to, I believe, is going to make most human labor obsolete.
Yeah, I agree with that. If you don't just mean AI, but you mean just internet technologies in general and data technologies. Oh, yes. I'm deeply concerned. I mean, if you look just at autonomous vehicles, I believe one out of every eight individuals in the U.S. is in a driving job.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to have devastating economic effects, but it's also going to have effects on the way that human beings understand themselves. I mean, what are we on Earth for? Where do we get our dignity from?
That's a good question. We'll hold the answer. Okay. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about conscious machines with Susan Snyder, author of Artificial You, AI and the Future of Your Mind.
Does artificial intelligence have the potential to enhance the human mind? Will we someday be able to wire AI modules up to our brain whenever we feel like it? And will we someday witness the so-called singularity in which human and machine are fully merged?
AI as mind enhancement when Philosophy Talk continues. Would a thinking, autonomous, conscious machine be anything more than a sad, sad robot? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Susan Snyder from the University of Connecticut, and we're thinking about conscious machines.
So back to the thing that we were talking about just at the last segment. John Stuart Mill is actually one of the first people to, in Unliberty, he says something like the following. I don't remember the exact quote. Suppose it were possible, he said, to get ditches dug, wars fought, cases tried, prayers said, churches built by a race of automata in human form. Then he goes on to say, well, why would we do that? Because if we did that, it would not make us as humans better. Our work is us. So the question should always be, how do we make us better? How do we perfect humankind? So I ask this question. People think about, you know, AI is mind enhancement and all that sort of stuff. I mean, can AI really make us better? I mean, that's the real question. Would turning over all this work to machines make us better off? Or would it make us worse off? Would augmenting our brain with this technology, would it make us better off? Would it perfect us or not? So what do you think about those kind of issues?
Well, I think AI regulation is absolutely crucial so that the future of artificial intelligence involves AI used for human flourishing. So in the context of technological unemployment, it would be super important to make sure that we reconceptualize work and, you know, have actually a good life and understand that it's time for us to spend time with our families or develop hobbies and understand ourselves differently. And to get there from here, we need to make sure that there are safe, you know, regulations, safe uses of these technologies so that humans just aren't unemployed and treated as if they're absolutely worthless.
I have the same worries about the merging idea, right? I mean, there's part of me that's very excited about the idea of the brain chip, right? I could remember everybody's name. This would be amazing. I mean, almost godlike capability to know things and so on. But there's another part of me that worries, well, how will I then understand myself? Will I then start to see myself little by little as just myself, a conscious machine? Wouldn't there be something a little demoralizing, deflating, disenchanting about this kind of life?
Would you even be left?
Would I be there at all?
Right? I mean, some successor to you that's part you and part this machine stuff, but would you be left? What do you think about this?
Well, yeah, in the second part of my book, I urge that if you walk into a center for mind design and you see a menu where there are a bunch of really exciting enhancements, you unfortunately need to think twice, because it may be that after enhancement, you are no longer yourself in any substantive way. And of course, on top of that worry, there's also worries about privacy of thought, cybersecurity. I mean, look at how our data is treated now. I mean, can you imagine if your thoughts become the new economic commodity? Oh, right. God.
Thought crime. Thought crime becomes real.
Totally. It could be a total cyberpunk dystopia.
Right. We've got a caller, Ovi from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Ovi, what's your comment or question?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to bring up the whole concept of automated feudalism. So this is more of a political aspect or a political economy aspect, where you're going to have mass unemployment and the very few people at the top who are going to be running things. And I find that in your program, you studiously avoid any setting of the context of political economy.
We don't, Ovi.
That affects the way we think, the way we see ourselves, the whole nine yards. In the capitalist society, it's all about capital accumulation.
Yeah, Ovi.
It's all about capital accumulation. You folks studiously avoid something.
No, thanks for the comment, Ovi, but I plead not guilty to studiously avoiding political. Indeed, I said, and I believe, that one of the things that drives us to want to create really sophisticated AI is that, I know neither
greed.
Of you like this, it's not just greed. We have always wanted complicated tools who are slave-like. A slave is the coolest tool imaginable. But human beings don't want to be mere tools to
and
one another.
And should not be.
Right, and so they always revolt. Okay, AI, disaggregate certain features and aggregate certain features, and then what will it allow us to do? Reintroduce slavery under another name. And that's a capitalist, I'm going back to Ovi, that's a capitalist imperative. Marx said as much, wage slavery. Well, the slaves don't have to, if you don't give them the capacity to form a certain kind of consciousness, then, well, you just get along. I think that is part of it. So
wow.
I'm on Ovi's side.
Yeah, and in fact, you have to ask in this context, who would own the means of production? It's actually whoever has the IP property rights on the algorithms. And that indeed is just a few people. And, you know, when you think about the impact on the global South, when there may be actually no owners of the means of production there, you really have to worry, you know, what is going to protect individuals.
And think of what slavery did to poor white Southerners, right? It held them. They may have think they benefit from it, but actually it made them answerable to the owning class, because they couldn't compete for certain labor, so they had to take what they were offered. So it not only enslaved them. Okay, so if we have a race of robot slaves and then we have a decrease in the demand for human employment, what does that do? How does that change the relationship between the owners of the means of production, who can now say, well, I'll just replace you by a robot if you don't like it? I think it's a very, I think OV is onto something very, very deep.
Very deep. And we also need to think about political stability. I mean, think about the impact that Rust Belt voters had on the election. Now think if the whole country feels completely alienated.
Which goes back to Mill. Why would we do this if what it's going to do is make us as a species worse off rather than better off? But we've got Malcolm from Oakland on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Malcolm. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I'm going back a little bit in the conversation, but my comment
My question, rather, is, aren't the ethics different in between a case where you take a being it's already complete, whether we like it or not, and you remove something from that being, compared to another being that only has ever as much as you decided to give it
exactly
in the first place?
Excellent question, Malcolm. That's the point. You and I are on the same side. Susan, what do you think
about
that?
That's why it's not Brave New World.
That's why it's not Brave New World, right? I said, in one way, in the other, Brave New World, you're denying people something, their destiny or something like that, but you decide what the destiny of the robot is. What do you think about that?
I think it's just not a good idea to create sentient beings and then tweak them so that all they want to do is please us. I think we have to also think about the benefit to the quality of life of the being we're creating. I mean, if it just, it feels like something to be them, but they're kind of warped and they just want to serve us.
So if you watch Westworld, brilliant.
Yes, of course.
Brilliant, brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it shows something. It's really complicated. It's way more complicated than even the most complicated robot dystopia stuff, but it's got an element that recurs throughout AI dystopian fiction. That is, we think we can find the sweet spot where these robots will be really, really cool and be very human-like tools and, like, amazing human-like tools, but they'll lack this thing, whatever it is that makes humans resist being turned into tool. But then it's really hard to figure that out. There's such a complicated bundle of, and if we give them this, they will just on their own evolve. And that's why it's so dangerous.
Especially if they get smart enough so that they can rewrite their own code.
Exactly.
As the character Maeve does in Westworld.
Exactly.
Right? What if they can rewrite their own code? Or what if it turns out that things like consciousness are emergent properties? If you just keep getting smarter and smarter, boom, eventually automatically consciousness just gets added in as an automatic byproduct. Then, boy, we're in real trouble if we try to design them, as Ken was saying.
Exactly.
Well, we got it just right. We hit the sweet spot. What do you think, Susan?
I think this makes it incredibly important that we develop tests for artificial consciousness, and that's why I work on such tests at Princeton and elsewhere and talk about them in the book. And
could you
I think
give an example?
We need to...
It's really fascinating. How
okay,
do you test for that?
Okay, well, here's one. So as we develop brain chips for parts of the brain that underlie conscious experience, I think we're going to learn several things. One thing we might learn is we might learn actually more about the neural basis of consciousness in the brain. But on top of that, we might learn whether chips could effectively replace conscious mental functions in a working brain. If it turns out that we don't get these crazy Oliver Sacks cases of deficits when individuals, you know, have brain chips in areas underlying conscious experience, I think we could imagine that the robots around us, if they're constructed with the same microchips, could be conscious.
Yeah, so you think we got a, there's a Rubicon that we could recognize. See, you're optimistic, I think. There's a Rubicon that we could recognize, and if we just don't go beyond that Rubicon, I think we don't really recognize it, because I don't think it comes down to just consciousness. I think it comes down to a bundle, and I don't think we really understand how all the things in the bundle. But before we let you go, there's a question from email from Alvin. I don't know if you can answer this, because I haven't read this book myself. Alvin from Berkeley asks, how much did the book Player Piano predict things today? Do you know that book? I don't either. So, Alvin, we don't know. Maybe a lot. Maybe a little.
Sorry, Alvin. I don't have a lot of time for reading.
Yeah.
Well, are there any sci-fi novels or shows that you think, boy, that really captures it?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, what's your favorite? Leave us with that. What's your favorite bit of...
My very fave. Okay, so I'm a big fan of Greg Egan, and I just did a piece in the Financial Times that was based on his stories involving the jewel. So read Learning to Be Me, short story, and wow, what a trip.
Tell me quickly about it. Just give me a...
Without spoiling the plot line, Egan depicts a situation where individuals have jewels or AI backup devices put into their brains. And over time, the jewel learns to be them, essentially. And then members of society decide that they are going to remove the biological brain and just kind of run on that jewel. And the real question there is, do you genuinely survive? What is the self? What is the person?
Right. Well, on that puzzling note, Susan, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been not an artificial, but a great conversation.
It's been real.
It's been real.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Susan Snyder. She's a professor of philosophy and director of the AI Mind and Society Group at the University of Connecticut. And she's author of the very fine book, Artificial You and the Future of Your Mind. So, Josh, what are you thinking today, my friend?
Humans are foolish, Ken Butt.
Okay, yeah. But besides that, yeah, what's your last thought about this?
Listen, you know, as a sci-fi fan myself, I'm very taken by various possibilities, including these dystopian possibilities or Matrix-like possibilities where we're going to get supplanted or something. But, you know, there's also the possibility that's adumbrated in Westworld that actually, you know, what we design might solve climate change. It might propose amazing new moral theories that will inspire us to be better. Or, third possibility, the movie Her.
Yeah.
They'll just ignore us altogether.
Yeah. No,
too
I mean,
good for us.
But here's the thing, I think. Look, John Stuart Mill, back to John Stuart Mill, has this other paper about the wisdom of nature, in which he said, well, nature has no wisdom, right? Nature is just the realm of happening. It has no wisdom. So people who say worship that, so he sounds like a gung-ho, build it, design it. But then he also says in On Liberty, if we could do this, if we could design a race of automata, what would be the point? His point is it's us. It's the design of us that matters, and we should attend to that. So the only question that ever matters to me is not who will profit, like will this corporation profit? Can they do it more efficiently or not efficiently? The only question, and a question that I think can only be answered by us collectively, is what will we become if we build a world like this? And should we build? That may sound anti-scientific because, like, oh, scientific curiosity, okay, technological progress. No, the question is, what will we become?
And Aristotle and Marx were optimistic about it, right? If we can delegate all of our work to beings like that.
Well, that's true. Marx was optimistic,
yeah.
But he thought the worker was the first one, right? Worker was the first one. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinker, where our motto is, with no apologies to the aforementioned Descartes, cogito ergo plago, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become our partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, or if you're bedeviled by a conundrum in your own life and could use some philosophical insight, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Now, would a thinking autonomous conscious machine even bother to talk this fast? It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, conscious machines, hasn't that been a running gag, a theme, a meme for close to a century now? Robots as pets. Robots as peevish maids, robots as lovable scamps, R2-D2, C-3PO, Robbie the robot, that robot in Lost in Space. They're conscious, sometimes evil, but mainly loyal, kind of like the cliches of black people they had in movies about the South before the Civil War, full of mansions and mint juleps, and black people in livery who just love bringing you canapes in the porch. They like being slaves. They don't have to worry about paychecks or their next meal, except in the real world, outside of Stephen Foster songs and blackface minstrel shows, people actually didn't like being slaves. They wind up seething with resentment. Revolutions occur. And slavery aside, many things about working do not make people happy. Not getting paid enough, working too many hours. All things work-related end up causing trouble at one time or another for all conscious beings. Even if you're your own boss, being self-employed for most of my adult life, I can tell you that the self can be as cruel a boss as you can imagine. The approaches, recriminations, demands for a raise I just can't provide, it's hell, I tell you. Robots do not feel this, which is why the idea of them replacing us in the workplace has so much appeal. Robots do the work while we sit in the shade with a mint julep and a magazine. Who pays for it? I don't know. Who pays us to do nothing while the robots do all the work? I don't know. And will robots become conscious and feel resentful eventually? Well, probably not. They're machines. We have built machines that can fool us into thinking they're human, but you know, I hate to break it to you, we are easily fooled. We love being fooled. Did the magician really saw that woman in half? No. That spaceship sure looks real. Just a movie. Did we really make Trump our president? Haha, joke's on us. So, to my way of thinking, you may have AI that seems like human thinking, but it's not. Be hard to prove, I guess. Turing test is just another quiz, really. How do you know if the Oasis is real or not unless you try to get a drink? How do you know if the con man is telling you the truth unless you give him the money and see for yourself? It's only a Ponzi scheme if you go broke. We make voice-activated applications now, which is a convenience for us, until we start to think they're real. I get robocalls now that are pretty much indistinguishable from real conversations. Calls from outfits trying to get me to have my carpets replaced or upgrade my security system, and they sound just like a crusty guy or a 40-something professional woman, and they engage with me. They take cues from what I'm saying. until I say, I'm a renter, and then the line goes dead. It's kind of like voting in the 18th century. Unless you own your own home, you don't get to pick the president or order siding from a robot. So to me, worrying about robot consciousness is beside the point. We are already imbuing them with consciousness, whether they have it or not. A better question might be, are humans conscious? Who's more real? We talk to Siri or Alexa like the upstairs maid we forgot to pay and the upstairs we don't have. We program our devices to speak to us in voices that are sexy yet neutral, warm, accommodating, eager to please but not too eager, friendly like a flight attendant or concierge or a Lyft driver or a barista. Not rude like a cabbie or a bartender or the guy behind you in line. It's a perfect world we're building. Service and goods with a smile. Of course, if robots do all the driving, all the delivering, all the lifting, and there's nothing left for us to do, where's the place for us in this perfect world? Well, maybe robots will be the customers too. Who needs people? All we need is the perfect feedback loop. Farm to table, money for goods, goods for services, services for money. In the loop that is capitalism, people kind of mess things up, don't they? I mean, who's really the loser here, Siri?
You are.
Got that right.
You have reached your destination.
Whoops, I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
After you've moved into your own permanent home, you'll enjoy mechanized servants. Until then, you can have a computerized dog. Rags!
Woof, woof, woof. Woof, woof, woof. Hello, I'm Rags. Woof, woof.
Is he housebroken or will he be leaving little batteries all over the floor?